I know.
What?
I killed that.
Did you? Oh, nice. I love that my next guest just chose this song. I was like, Tom, when did the homosexual jump out of you to pick this song? Shout out to Tom. Shout out to Christian here in studio with Hey Jorge. Please visit heyjorge.com for a lot of the stuff that we will be, literally in the next few weeks, got a lot of new content coming up. Oh, it's down. No. Okay, good point. Don't go to heyjorge.com. It's down for maintenance. Go to facebook.com/hxtv1. Go to hxtv1 on Facebook. You can see our live video. We're here for the next hour and a half. I'm very excited for this next conversation because, as you know, I speak very openly about my queer identity and what that journey has been like as somebody from the Texas-Mexico border, somebody who is in this Mexican-American skin, somebody who is Catholic and still goes to church and tries to figure out whether or not the Catholic Church is still the right place for him because of just the despicable things it continues to do to my community. But very excited for this next conversation with Dr. Perry Halkidis. Now, Dr. Perry is a dean and professor at the School of Public Health at Rutgers University, and for over two decades, Dr. Halkidis' program of research has examined the intersection of HIV and other STIs, sexually transmitted infections, drug abuse, and mental health burden, because a lot of things that people don't really focus on what the mental health aspect of coming out and queer identity is, especially right now during the Trump administration. But there's a lot of intersections in the work that he does. His most recent book, The AIDS Generation, Stories of Survival and Resilience, was a 2014 Lambda Literary Award nominee and the recipient of the American Psychological Association Distinguished Book Award in LGBT Psychology. But his latest book is the one we're going to talk about right now, called Out in Time, The Public Lives of Gay Men from Stonewall to the Queer Generation. Because in the 50 years since the happening of the Stonewall Uprising, we've seen three generations of queer men come forward, right? We've seen the Stonewall generation, the AIDS generation, and then right now the queer generation, which I guess is something that I can say myself because we've now adopted the word queer. We've reclaimed that word, and we're using that to be a little more, I mean, we'll talk about it. We'll talk about that and what that all necessarily means. But very excited to welcome Dr. Perry here to our show on Affirmative Reaction. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me. Great.
So, like we were talking about this during the break, but the idea that this is all taking place, that it's all such weird timing, right? The 50th anniversary of Stonewall during a Trump presidency. We think that we've come so far, but then we're confronted with the government that makes us say, well, maybe not so much. So talk about what this past year has been like, especially in promoting the book because of the political environment we're in.
Yeah. So again, so thanks for having me. And I actually, I love that, you know, your identity as a Catholic and as a, you know, as a, you know, as a Latino and as a queer man, it intersects, because I think a lot of why I wrote this book was to tell the stories of many different kinds of individuals, right? Because I think this notion that it's so easy to be a gay man in 2019 is false. Anyway, so it's been a fascinating journey, you know. And, you know, under this presidency, a president who like wants to bring an end to AIDS from one side of his mouth, and then from the other side of his mouth says, oh, I don't know, doctors don't have to treat trans people and gay people if they don't want to, and trans people can't serve in the military. And I, you know, I've spent my life, the last 25 years of my life, talking about how social conditions fuel health disparities in my population of gay men and an LGBT population, and this president wants to bring an end to AIDS. He's just making the health conditions worse. And so it's been saddening, but at the same time energizing, because I think, you know, as a man who came of age during the AIDS crisis, we came together and we fought. And so I'm hoping we do the same thing here.
Now, part of the book is it's your conversation with 15 different men from these different generations and trying to see how a lot of the same themes might be working towards them. And of course, one of the biggest one is coming out, either coming out or being forced out. And one would imagine that during the Stonewall generation, a lot of that is being forced out, with the exception of those who were visible at Stonewall, where a lot of it was just coming out and being and living in one's truth. But I think that's still something that still happens today, this pervasive nature of, depending on where you live, you're forced out more than you are allowing yourself to come out.
Yeah, so I think that the healthiest resolution for people is when it's their time to come out and when they're ready to come out. And what I wanted to do with these stories, especially for the young guys, the guys who are like in their 20s, is say that, you know, it's not a walk in the park for them either. Mm-hmm. And some of them are being forced out too. And this notion, like, I, you know, one of the episodes of Will and Grace that really annoyed the hell out of me this year was the episode where Ben Platt was on, and he like made it sound like it was so easy for him to come out. And maybe if you're like a white upper middle class guy, right, maybe it is. Mm-hmm. But for the rest of us, it's a very complicated reality. And so what's interesting is to see that across the 50 years, from the 19-year-old to the 78-year-old who I interviewed, the psychological process of coming out, just as hard as it was 50 years ago, mm-hmm. just as challenging.
You said 17-year-old, right?
19-year-old. Yeah.
So I would ask, just because I have those numbers fresh in my head, what did you have in common with each of those individuals, with the 19-year-old and the 78-year-old, since you yourself say, you fall within one of the generations as well.
Right. So, you know, I'm the child of Greek immigrants, you know, and I actually resonated a lot with the younger guys because several of them were children of immigrants too. And, you know, what we had in common was this notion that we were going to somehow be rejected by our family, be rejected by our church, be rejected by our community. And the story I tell over and over and over again, and it's one of my favorite stories, and this is why the book is dedicated to my best friend George, is that when I came out at 18, left Astoria, Queens, where all the Greeks were, because we were all like settled there, went to Columbia, came back one weekend to do my laundry, I guess, or something like that. I was out and the word had gotten out in the community and everybody was buzzing. My friend George, I bumped him on the street and I said to him, "Hey, George, you know, you must have heard all the Greeks are talking about it. They're buzzing about it. I'm gay." And mm-hmm. his response was, "Are we going to a Met game this weekend?" And that's the response I wanted from everyone, right? Mm-hmm. But who wants to go to the Mets anyway? But you know, but that is not. My story is, you know, very similar story to Yasser, who is a young man who, Ghanaian ancestry, who had to get drunk while he was at college to call his father to tell him, who was a member of the Pentecostal church, right? So not so different in 2016 than it was for me in 1981.
What was your association with the church? And because, like you say, there are a lot of people who talk about in the book about what I've come to phrase as spiritual violence, this idea that the church would not be accepting, either because of explicit things that have been told to them from these authority figures, whether priests, clerics, anything like that. But how does that factor into all of this?
Yeah, so that's a great question. In fact, the inspiration for the book was the church. I grew up in the Greek Orthodox Church, you know, kind of like Catholic, but mm-hmm. you know, basically a little more mystical, a little more incense, I think, going on there. But my mother died like 5 years ago, and you know, mm-hmm. I did all the things you're supposed to do, which is like all of those memorial things. And you know, at one of the memorials, the 40-day memorial, the priest in the church in Astoria went out of his way to like degrade, you know, marriage equality, knowing perfectly well that my husband and I were there, right? And that was the inspiration. And then a week later, my cousin's son, James, came out to us. So out of that came something beautiful, mm-hmm. right? But it was like, once again, here was this priest cutting through me at like 50-something years old with his words. Mm-hmm. So my relationship with the church is complicated. I will say that in the recent time, a second or third cousin of mine who is a bigwig in the church has reached out to me. And I've been doing work with the Greek Orthodox Church on human trafficking.
So
I think there's a way to reconcile these things, right? Yeah. Like bring the science and the knowledge to the table. Maybe we'll bring them to the 21st century.
I mean, part of, in every queer person I know has had this thought of being disowned or being rejected. And I think that continues to this day, queer people talk about all the time, you're always constantly coming out, depending on if you're in a new situation, you're at a new job, you're just in a new setting, regardless, there's always that thing where you have to say, oh, well, this is my partner. Oh, that means you're gay. Oh, that means this. Like it, that constantly moves forward. But I'm curious for the people that you talk to in the Stonewall generation, talk about how the reaction to their coming out was and how that differs from the other people that you spoke with generations after.
Yeah, and I think the theme that you're talking about, which I think is consistent, is that feeling of otherness that we all have mm-hmm. all of our lives, right? It never really goes away, right? And I actually see it as a root cause for a lot of the health challenges that, you know, LGBTQ people face. So for the people of the Stonewall, you know, generation, it was like complete rejection by their families. It was just like complete, you know, they were kicked out. They didn't have anything to do with them, or they kept silent about their sexuality for most of their lives. So it's like negotiate a good part of their identity, a good part of their lives suppressing their identities. What I think is different nowadays, if I was going to say there's one improvement, it's the representations of LGBTQ people in film, in media, in other artistic art forms, right? Mm-hmm. And so when you're out there, like when I was growing up, it was like Stephen Carrington on Crystal. Only the old people will know that reference. on Dynasty, I mean, you know, and he was like, you know, this gay guy who then kind of became straight and whatever. But now, I mean, you can, well, see, there's Moonlight and there's Beach Rats and there's all these like really amazing multidimensional representations of LGBTQ people. And I think that makes it a little bit easier to feel like you're not alone, right? Mm-hmm. So even if your family rejects you And these lots of these kids have familial rejection. There, you know that you're out there in a world where there are other people like you.
And a lot of that rejection comes because of society's thoughts on masculinity, right?
Correct.
And that's one of the themes that's talked about in the book. This idea that everybody's born with this idea of how they should look, how they should dress, how they should speak. I've had, when I was growing up, had a lot to deal with my what I thought was my gay voice and trying to figure out like, should I tone it down? Should I this? Should I that? And then when it comes to presentation, like how one necessarily presents themselves to the world, is this a little too flamboyant? Is this like going to keep me going under the radar? So talk about how that came up, the exploration of masculinity with your subjects.
Yeah, so one of my favorite researchers, a colleague of mine here in New York, Alex Carballo-Diegues, who writes about Latino, you know, gay men and about the idea that if you're a top, you're not really gay, but if you're a bottom, you're gay, right? Mm-hmm. This whole idea of machismo. And so, you know, hypermasculinity or toxic masculinity or masculinity so fragile, there's a million things we could call it, mm-hmm. plays out really, really, really strongly in the Stonewall guys and in the AIDS generation guys. And I've actually written about this idea that, you know, in the present, and when you're being called a sissy and you're frail and you're sickly, which the AIDS epidemic did make us seem like, you're going to turn to this hyper-masculine conception, right? And then you're going to be butch and virile. And unfortunately, what ends up happening when you espouse such an identity is you then, you know, you vilify people who are in your own community who don't espouse those identities also. And that's a problem. What's incredible, though, is the younger generation. I've learned so much by interviewing the younger guys. They are much more combative towards this notion that there's one idea of masculinity. And I come back to this, to one of the young men in the book, Yasser. Ghanaian, big guy, handsome, built, comes in, and he puts his hands on the table, and he's got these long yellow fingernails. And I'm like, perfect. That's exactly right.
Yeah,
that's perfect.
It's people who have a middle finger and just say fuck you to gender and fuck you to these norms that we've just conditioned ourselves to believe after all these years. So I think that's always been the biggest thing, like trying to figure out where one lies within this gender masculinity spectrum and how that has changed dramatically for myself. I should let y'all know you are listening to Affirmative Reaction. I'm Jorge Olivares, joined here in studio with Dr. Perry Halkidas, who is the author of Out in Time. Something else that I also want to make sure that we talk about is this idea of mortality, right? So in the Stonewall generation, one would believe, especially during the 60s, this idea of free love, and then confronted in the AIDS generation of, oh shit, we can die, and a lot of us are dying, and we're dying at young ages, to now where we have this PrEP generation, these guys who are taking pre-exposure prophylaxis or PrEP, which when taken as directed and with the use of condoms is 99% effective as to preventing HIV. And so we're back to this whole idea of a lot of people who are having sex and doing things in ways thinking as though AIDS is far removed from them, that HIV contraction is far removed from them. So if we can, the evolution of mortality and how one views their mortality based off of the conversations you had.
Yeah, so it's complicated. I also see it as the idea of hope, right? So so like for the Stonewall guys, there was little hope in terms of being able to live their lives openly. For my generation, we thought we were all going to die. There was no hope at all. I think for young guys, it's a whole issue of economic hope, right? There's like limited economic hope, right? So it's like, you know, and it's quite frankly, and I feel for the queer generation. But this idea of mortality and power, I mean, I think PrEP is not, you know, the savior that's going to like get rid of the epidemic. Ultimately, the cure is, right? Mm-hmm. It's another tool in our arsenal, right? We're not doing a very good job of putting it out there. But I do think young gay men are more empowered now than they were even 10 years ago to be able to control their sexual lives and their health. Look, I mean, I wrote in 1999, the condom is as much an emotional barrier as it is a physical barrier, right? You know, and I really strongly believe that. And I think that intimacy that so many queer people struggle with manifests in young queer people too. So if they can safely have sex without condoms, right, because of PrEP, and let's be clear, you can get other STIs.
Yes.
I feel like I have to make that public service announcement.
But it's a huge distinction that a lot of people forget, that you could still contract other sexually transmitted infections. Even if you're on PrEP, it just makes it that much more difficult for you to contract HIV.
Exactly. And like, you know, and it's in some ways, HIV is the much more controllable of all of the things now between PrEP and, you know, the idea that undetectable equals untransmittable, which all of a sudden legitimizes in my mind or allows positive people to feel like they're not the pariahs they've been made to feel like their whole lives, right? Those are really powerful tools. But you're right. I mean, the other, like STIs last year in gay men, through the roof.
It was like the rates of syphilis. And isn't there like a strand of gonorrhea that's now even much more difficult to contain?
There's only one, I think, one additional formulation of antibiotic to deal with the current states of gonorrhea in our country. There are resistant strains. And if that gets out of control, then there we are again. And we have another STI there, right?
But I do just want to make sure that so for people who are just tuning in who aren't quite familiar with what exactly undetectable equals untransmittable means, this new U equals U campaign, if you can kind of let people know about that.
So the Swiss knew this in 2008, because you know those damn Swiss, they're always like ahead of the curve, right? In 2008, the Swiss came out with a statement which said that if somebody's an HIV positive person and there are medications and there's no evidence of virus in their blood, it probably means there's no evidence of virus in their semen or in their vaginal fluids or what have you, they cannot transmit HIV to their negative partner even without use of a condom, right? And everybody was like, no, stop, the Swiss are liars, right? But lo and behold, it's true. And in 2017, Bruce Rickman and the Prevention Access Campaign, which I work with, you know, continue to develop this message. And the message we came up with is the same message of undetectable. If you have undetectable viral load, you are untransmittable. And the CDC espoused that. Mm-hmm. And like over 1,000 organizations around the world, the country of Canada espoused that idea. So basically it means if you're a positive person and you're on medications and you're taking your medications every day and you have no viral load, lots of ifs there. Mm-hmm. You cannot transmit HIV to your partner if you don't use a condom.
Yeah. I just to kind of go back to this idea of mortality, though, and death, I think when I was younger and I was trying to figure out what this gayness meant, right? And I don't know why, one of the first movies I saw was Philadelphia. Mm. And I thought that, okay, I'm probably going to die soon. Like, I have to worry about what this all means. Granted, early 90s, I was in elementary school. Like, I don't know what the fuck I was thinking. But those are the images you see first. And so I'm curious about whether or not there was conversations about death. Because there was, I mean, I can assume those who are part of the Stonewall generation, they're entering the final chapters of their life just by the very nature of a lot of time has passed since then. AIDS generation, some people who are still living with the virus and still trying to figure out what that all means. And I don't want to say necessarily the Superman complex that the queer generation has, but this idea that we don't necessarily have to worry about death any more differently than the person next to us.
I think there's a sense of mortality still, though, among the queer guys. You know, I think there's still a sense that, you know, some of the guys, a couple of the guys of the queer journalists, I think at least one was HIV positive. And this notion that HIV is gone and that, you know, there's great hope for us. I mean, I think for the most part, if you were to like look at a trend, there's probably less sense of mortality than there was in the past. But I think just as an LGBTQ person, you always feel fatalistic, right? You always feel like if it's not HIV that's going to get me, it's, you know, it's going to be those horrible, deplorable people who are going to be the hell out of me, or it's going to be a president who's going to take away my rights. You know, like, you know, I'm always like, you know, my husband and I got married 10 years ago this August in Connecticut. When marriage equality passed in New York, we got married in New York just in case.
Yeah.
Right. So you always live with the other shoe dropping, right? You know, and I think that's consistent across time. And until we get to a place where we say, like, you know, being an LGBTQ person, being an LGBTQ person of color, being a trans person, whatever, is just part of the American story. Which means we teach LGBTQ history in schools. New Jersey and California. Right?
For real.
Right? Then it's never going to go away, that sense of like something bad is going to happen to us.
Yeah, I'm glad you made that point because I was looking at it too much from the health framework of it only being regarding HIV or AIDS and not about the fact that people might want to kill us in the streets. I would ask you, what was the most startling thing or the most surprising thing you learned after completing these interviews and compiling this book?
Yeah, so I would say it wasn't surprising, but it was amazing to me how amplified it was, you know, and I'd written about this before, this notion of racism within the LGBTQ population, you know, and I think, you know, I've spoken very openly about this and, you know, and I own my place in the world as, like, you know, a white man, right? And I know the power and the privilege that I have, you know, because I'm a white man. But, you know, I wrote an op-ed for the New York Star Ledger about a year and a half ago. And I remember going back to work the next day and people had read and they were like, we had no idea. I'm like, why would LGBTQ people be any different than anybody else?
Yeah.
You know, they would be racist. So I think what was incredible to me was the articulation of these experiences by the younger guys, their ability to have this really, really nuanced discussion and understanding of gender and race and culture and class, which really brought me to a very, very elevated place in my thinking, which was totally absent from the older guys. Mm. And not surprising to me, right?
Yeah, because I think more so now, this conversation of intersectionality is happening at this moment and wasn't necessarily in the front of people's minds.
No, there were different issues to deal with. So, like, you know, the Stonewall guys, like, were like, please just don't arrest me or beat the hell out of me. Like, although we're saying don't beat the hell out of me now still, right? Yeah. The AIDS guys were like, we're trying not to die here, right? So there was not, you know, in some ways, those experiences of those two generations lay the foundation for these conversations about intersectionality. And these conversations are crucially important to have, not just in the LGBTQ population, but in the country at large. I think what we're seeing in the political arena in our country is this notion that a country doesn't look like what some people want it to look like, mm-hmm. right? And so, like the last vestiges of the Catholic Church, which goes kicking and screaming, this is the last vestiges of these folks who are like trying to hold on to something that isn't real anymore. And, you know, I think this notion of intersectionality is a beautiful thing. Mm-hmm. This notion that, you know, I am a gay man, I am a white man, I'm a professor, like I am a husband, I am a Greek man. Like, we're not just one thing. And the young guys were amazing when they were talking about those stories. But I want to really point out that I think we have work to do in our population. Mm-hmm. Around these issues. You know, we have work to do about like what we think about is an ideal gay man, right? You know, it's not that chiseled white guy on the beach in Fire Island Pines, you know, and what, you know, which is sometimes what is portrayed to us, you know, and we've got to stop, using language and words that I think vilify members of the population who are not white folks. And I've been really adamant about that. And I think that in my life as an elder spokesman at this point, it's my job to make sure that, you know, I call out my peers who do that.
Mm-hmm. In the last couple of minutes we have, because you come to us with, I should let other people know that aside from writing the book, the Dean and Professor at the School of Public Health at Rutgers University, what are some of the stuff that you've been working on or some of the research that you've had a chance to look at that continues to inform what you do now?
Yeah, so I'm really proud to say, so I've been the dean there for 2 years. I'm just about to start my third year. We are the first public health school in the world to have a whole concentration on LGBTQ public health.
Wow.
That's huge. People have certificates, they have two or three courses. We have a whole concentration, and that's just amazing. And I'm incredibly, incredibly proud of that. So I've been working on. I've been building a school that like looks like the population of the United States, because mm-hmm. I think that if you are a public health person, you should train public health people that look like the population, right? Mm-hmm. So that's what I've been doing. But also in my own research, I've been really interested in this idea of aging and resilience in HIV. And I think that, and the resilience idea, I think, also manifests across the generations. Like, how is it that we as a population that are put upon so much continue to succeed as well as we do mm-hmm. in this country, continue to have the emotional health that we do, despite everything that's put upon us? And there is a fortitude and a strength and lessons there that I think speak to everybody about, you know, how they can navigate their lives in very difficult circumstances.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming in to this Saturday to speak with me. I know we had tried to do this about a month ago, but unfortunately we had to change some plans. But wonderful conversation.
Love it.
And I appreciate you. And I appreciate, for those of you who want a chance to buy the book, it's called Out in Time, The Public Lives of Gay Men from Stonewall to the Queer Generation by Dr. Perry Halkidis. And if people want to follow you, it's Dr. P.N. Halkidis, correct?
Yeah, Dr. P.N. Halkidis on Twitter. It's also on Instagram. And perryanhalkidis.com is my website.
Nice. Awesome. Thank you so much.